Hi, this is the Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer.
And you're listening to Endeavors.
Welcome to the show, everybody. The song you just heard was Forever Fool by Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer off their new album Apocalypse Stick. And I'll be chatting to them, I don't know, half an hour from now, I suppose, they'll be on. But right now, I want to talk about a new Canadian indie that is coming out on Friday and that I got to see back in December. It's called Birdland, and it involves a cop, an ornithologist, a shady businessman, and a lounge singer, among others. The film's writer-director is Peter Lynch, and to tell you the type of guy he is, Canada's grandfather of, or Canada's father of indie cinema, Adam Egoyan, calls Peter Lynch the most esoteric director working in the country today. So I think that's saying something. The film stars Kathleen Monroe, David Aupay, who's also worked with Adam Egoyan, you may remember in Ararat, Benjamin Ayers, George Jarski, Melanie Scrofano from one of my favorite shows, Winona Earp, Cara G, and Stephen McHattie. I got a chance to speak both with director Stephen Lynch and Cara G in separate interviews. So first you're going to hear Cara talk about her role in the film. Here's me with Cara G. Cara G, hello, welcome, good afternoon.
Good afternoon indeed.
How are you coping with this weather that doesn't seem to want to leave us alone?
I'm moving to Los Angeles. I'm planning to move I will have to be here for a few weeks in the terrible winter, and actually I'm going to Winnipeg to shoot a project before then, but then I'm making my way to the palm trees, so that's how I'm coping.
Nice and warm, I guess. That's why so many actors move there, right? It's really the weather.
Honestly, I'm so thrilled that the center of this industry is not in, like, I don't know, you know, somewhere really cold. It's pretty lucky that I get to justify moving to the Palms with the whole career thing, you know?
Yeah. So you're in a new film, Birdland. I had a chance to see this last month, and I got to speak with Peter. How did this project come to you? Was it sort of a normal audition process, or did Peter come to you and offer you the role?
Peter reached out to me and sent me the script, and then he and I met. We had a drink together at the Drake, and we talked about the project. I met with Kat, one of the producers, and they just seemed like really cool people. So I was really happy to take the project on. This is a while ago now. We shot it ages ago, so I'm thrilled that it's coming out soon. It's going to be great to share it, you know?
What's that like for you as an actress, having shot something, you know, maybe a year or so or longer ago, and then that having it just come out now? Is it interesting to revisit that project when everybody's seeing it, and take a and go back and revisit it, and perhaps take a break from some of the other stuff that you're working on?
Yeah, it's I mean, it's so strange, right? It's like going back in time. It was a few years ago that we shot that now. So it's like looking back at this older version of myself. And I mean, it's wonderful to see how something turns out, especially this project. It's so visually stunning that it's going to be great to see it on a big screen, I think. And you know, you never know what something's going to look like when you're in the midst of shooting it. So, yeah, it's a little trip down memory lane for me.
There's so much going on in this film. How much of, like, when you were sent the original, you know, when Peter first sent you the script, how much of what you saw on the page, how similar was that to the final project? How much did it morph and change over the course of shooting, if at all?
You know, it morphed and changed a lot. You know, it's such a long time ago, actually. It's difficult to speak to that specifically. And I'll have to watch this cut again. It's been a while since I've seen it. And I think the version I saw was perhaps a slightly different edit. But this story, because it's about sort of tackling these issues of surveillance and fractured memory, it jumps around a lot, and definitely there are differences in how it has turned out compared to the script that that I originally read. So yeah, it's neat to see it grow.
There's a couple of scenes in the film where your character is singing in a seedy sort of jazz lounge. The art of lounge singing is an old, very old film motif. Did you approach that part of the role any differently because there's that added layer of performing while you're performing, so to speak?
Yeah, I don't know how this happens. It's happened a few times now where I've been cast as a singer, and that's like so not. I went to theater school, so I did some voice training in theater school, but I don't consider myself a singer. So I sort of approached the character like, oh, this is such a like cop out, but I was like, you know, hey, the character doesn't necessarily have to be the best lounge singer. Like, there's something a bit, I think, delusional about the character and the fact that she might not be the best singer. I sort of wanted to incorporate that reality in, and that she thinks that she's something that maybe she's not. So that was my take on the singing.
With a film like this, where you're not entirely sure of what is happening, perhaps, and until the very end, did Peter tell you what sort of the end result of the film was, or did you find yourself figuring it out as you shot it, or figuring it out as you watched it?
I mean, we knew the major plot points, of course, having read the script. So we were sort of aware of how that mystery was, how it was intending to unfold. And then just sort of crafting my character's arc in and around that mystery and plotting, you know, what does my character know at this point? For each and every scene as the mystery unfolds, is that was my task in all of it. So yeah, that was how I approached that.
You get to play the daughter of Canada's one of Canada's most celebrated actors, Stephen McHattie. Working with somebody like him, what was that experience like for you?
I loved working with him. I thought he was fantastic. He's, he's such a powerful performer. I feel like I got to work. It was a pretty stacked cast. So getting to work with Stephen was great. Getting to work with Kathleen as someone who I have admired so much, and sharing scenes with her and figuring our scenes out with her and with Melanie. And I feel like there was just so many. That getting to work with those two especially was particularly inspiring. So yeah, I feel like we had a pretty stacked cast, and of course I get to make out with everybody.
is that easy or difficult as an actor when you have to have those types of intimate scenes?
I don't know. It's like it's pretty. It's like it's just part of the job, and it's mostly awkward, and you're thinking about, you know, the angle of the camera, and I don't know, I try to have a sense of humor about it, and I don't, it's so silly, it's mostly silly.
And now in addition to this, I know you also have a couple other projects coming up. I'm really intrigued by your film Red Rover. I know you get to work with Shane Belcourt in that. What can you tell us about that project?
Oh, that one! I'm so excited. I haven't seen it yet, so I'm really, really, really excited to see how it all turns out. I think that was such a great opportunity to do a romantic comedy, and the characters that Christian Brune and I play are sort of the characters that you often see more as the sidekick characters, I think, in a traditional romantic comedy. So it's these people who are just sort of quirky and maybe damaged in some way. And so to see them take center stage and follow their exploits was just really, I felt such tenderness towards the characters in that one. So I'm really excited to see how it turns out. Yeah. And another singer, I play another singer in that. Crazy.
I feel like the rom-com is a genre that's kind of been reinvented in the last, you know, 5, 10 years or so. What do you like about that style of story, and why do you think it's one that has continually made an impact on people over the years?
Well, I think, I mean, Red Rover in particular, that is one of the loveliest scripts I've been offered. So I was enthused about that one in particular, as I said, because it's sort of the characters who are more often on the sidelines of that story, you know. I think that, I mean, obviously our quest for love is so universal, but I think that genre is often, you know, so, especially, I mean, I guess here in North America, it's generally a very whitewashed, very heteronormative sort of, you know, genre. I think like Julia Roberts and blah, blah, blah. And that doesn't interest me very much at all, I must say. But I think that we're seeing right now this really interesting surge of, I don't know, energy that we're looking at, you know, more inclusive and interesting stories. I'm thinking of something like The Big Sick, which I loved, which we're seeing an interracial relationship and the challenges that come along with that storyline. And we don't, you know, we haven't seen stuff like that. And I think that Red Rover sort of has, you know, a fresh and interesting take on that, in that genre.
And another project that you're appearing in is Historic Homes of the Future.
You are on it. You're good.
What can you tell us about that?
That one, I don't know anything. I haven't seen it. We just finished shooting it in the fall. We shot it in North Bay. I hope with my whole heart and soul that it is powerful. So I think that it definitely has the potential to be a really, really powerful film, and that I hope that it turns out that way. So I will definitely be curious and excited to see how that turns out, you know. I was very invested in the script and the story.
You mentioned Christian Brune, your co-star in Red Rover, and is it true that you guys are in pre-production on a short film together called Home in Time?
Yes, that's exactly correct. In fact, I'm going to my first costume fitting for that one when we're off the phone. So yes, that is that's coming up, which I'm excited about.
The dynamic of working with somebody that you've already worked with in the past, how do you think that's going to impact filming?
I'm excited to see him. I like Christian Brune so much. I feel like anyone who's worked with him adores him. So I feel excited about it. Yeah.
And are we going to see you at all in season 3 of The Expanse?
Yes, you are. And that I am so excited about. That project, I honestly, sometimes, I was at the coffee shop earlier today and I'm reading on in the novels, and I was reading my book at the coffee shop, and it just gives me goosebumps to think of what it's going to be like to share season 3. I've seen the first 2 episodes. We got together as a cast and crew and watched the first 2 episodes at the Lightbox, actually on a big screen, and they're so, so good. I was a big fan of that show, actually, the first season, before I joined in the second season. So I'm like, that is, oh, God, it just is the most exciting thing in the world. And I can't wait to share season 3. I can't wait to see it. So, yeah.
Would you call yourself a sci-fi fan?
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. I think definitely growing up, I was a big fan of science fiction novels. And they definitely were a big part of developing my taste as I grew up. So I think that The Expanse is really, really special. I think that they are that the story is just so interesting philosophically and politically. I think science fiction has the ability to show us what might be possible and to explore that and to look back on our life here on Earth with a sense of awe and wonder and perspective is something very, very beautiful that we can do in science fiction, we can achieve. So, yeah,
what I am. What was the dynamic for you of sort of joining this TV family at you know, that was sort of already in progress?
Well, I definitely came to set a few days before I started shooting so that I could nerd out on the sets and not freak out on my first day of actual filming. So for me, it was a thrill and a joy. I was such a huge, huge fan of the show. Jean Yoon is a dear friend of mine, and she had played a beautiful, beautiful role in the first season. And so I spoke with her about it when I was cast, and she had such a positive experience on the show as well. They have a real knack for writing female characters who are complex and intelligent and competent and doing exciting things. So that has been just a joy. It's been a joy. And everyone is so nice. I feel like it's a really, really warm and welcoming film set where everyone is just so excited to be there. Everyone's like, it's the dream job. It's the actual dream, working on something like that. And everyone there is aware of that and grateful to be there. So it's pretty joyful.
Speaking of living in the dream, you mentioned that you are making the move to LA later this year.
Yeah.
As an actress, as a performer, it's all, you know, it's all something that everyone strives to do. But why was the time right for you to make that next step in your career?
Well, I just, there's more opportunity for me down there. I think. You know, that's where that's really the epicenter of the industry, and I have to keep pushing forward. I'm quite ambitious, so I'm curious to see how I can continue to advance my career, and that's the place to do it, really. I think especially in terms of diversity in casting. And it might just be because of the size of the market, but they're definitely quite a bit further ahead of us in the United States than we are in Canada. So I definitely see more opportunity on that front, especially in television, you know.
Yeah. What?
After, I was just going to say, after doing Strange Empire, I think, which was an amazing opportunity, but it wasn't until being cast in an American production, you know, that I've had another chance to really take a crack at a good, juicy role in on a television show. And I want to just keep doing more of that. So that's the place to be.
Where do you think the Canadian film industry is on a diversity level?
Well, I think... we definitely have some gains to be made still. I think that my experience has been that we have seen made some gains, certainly in the film industry. I think we're pretty far behind in television. I think we have a lot of work to do. I think we have an awful lot of work to do still. I think that in Canada, we really like to pat ourselves on the back and think that we are we are somehow more progressive than in the United States. And I think that's really dangerous because we have a lot of work to do here as well.
Well, the film is Birdland, and it will be screening as part of a Q&A on January the 23rd, and then I think it opens up on the 26th?
Yeah.
Kara G., thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for chatting. I really appreciate it, Dan.
Alrighty, have a good day. Ciao.
Bye.
That was Kara G., and she's one of the stars of Birdland. Peter Lynch wrote and directed the film. And back in December, I spoke with him about what it was like to transition from documentary to narrative storytelling, why he chose ornithology, and the idea behind the film. This is me with writer-director of Birdland, Peter Lynch. Peter Lynch, hello, welcome.
Hi there.
How are you doing today? Surviving the snow?
Yeah, I got here on public transit.
The film is Birdland, and I know you've spent the majority of your career making and working in documentaries. In terms of sort of piecing together a piece of narrative fiction, how for you does that different than constructing a story that's true, or at least based on true events?
It's interesting. The biggest difference is obviously the writing, you know, like that you have to, a great deal of time goes into the writing. But outside of that, the lines start to blur fairly early on, in that some of the ideas often come from life. And also when you're working in documentary, sometimes you're looking for a moment of truth, and people lie, for example. So that kind of process of working with actors and real people is very similar in the sense that you're looking for authenticity. You're looking for them to... everybody performs, you know, and when you put a camera on people, they perform. And just like Hood in the movie, the central character, who's the cop, her own personal investigation, she starts to behave differently when cameras are on. So it's a process. Once you start to roll cameras, things always start to blur. So that, I think that's my first answer about that.
In terms of the actual writing of the script, how did you connect with that process and find out how it may be similar or different to when you're writing a documentary feature?
It's a very, this happened over a number of years. It first started where I wrote a short story, and then I co-wrote a short with another writer named Lee Gowan, who's an author, a novelist. So we then thought, hey, a lot of people said this could be a feature. So he and I co-wrote a feature-length version. It was called Blackbird at the time, and it was about over a decade ago. And a number of things happened that sort of derailed the project. His father died, and then a story editor that I was working with, Paul Corrington, he started to get sick, and all these things sort of, I just shelved them. And I was in Newfoundland. My wife was working as an editor who edited this film, Birdland. She's was working on Republic of Doyle, and I started to just picked out the script out of my computer and looked down at it and said, at the time it was called Blackbird, and I just started writing again, and I rewrote it entirely, but, you know, based on some of the characters and things like that. So it's a grueling process. I mean, it takes time. You have to put in your time, and it's, you have to make it, the biggest thing is to show it to other people. It's for other people to understand it. So when you're making a doc, you show rough cuts, but you're sort of like, what you get is people sort of accept it because it's real and because that's what you shot. Whereas writing, it could be anything. And that's the hard part, is to convince people that this is a story worth filming.
But even before you get to picture and before cameras are rolling, the emotions of actually sharing a piece of your work, because often writing can be very personal, sharing that with others, how difficult a process can that be?
It's a very humbling process, because it's, you make a lot of assumptions of what people will understand. But it's also exhilarating when people respond positively, especially when the actors are interested, and other key collaborators start to see your vision. But it is very, filmmaking, as you know, is very collaborative, and documentary is to quite an extent too, but there's just a process that you spend a lot of time alone at first, and then it becomes the opposite. You spend a lot of time convincing people and communicating to people what it is that it needs to be filmed. And that involves, you know, your cinematographer, your production designer, your editor. So all these people start to weigh in and give you notes. And it's a very, you know, it's an ongoing process right up to the minute that you're filming. Even before the film is completed, the writing is always in a dynamic process.
The title of the film is called Birdland, and we do hear a couple of the characters sing the song. Did the title come from the song, or did you include the song in the film once you already had that title?
A little bit of both. I mean, because initially the film I had called it Blackbird, and then Lullaby of Birdland, the famous standard, was a song that I was really interested in, and it takes place, the characters perform it in a nightclub in the story. So it organically evolved into Birdland, sort of. And I know a lot of people say, oh, it's at the famous jazz bar, which it is in New York. There's a famous jazz bar, Birdland Club, nightclub. But this is, Birdland in this case is a multi-layered metaphor where it's connected to the characters. I even saw the women as these kind of bird-like characters.
What do you think it is, you know, sort of jazz bars have sort of long been associated with, you know, maybe mafia or a little bit more unsavory characters. In terms of a motif for storytelling and crime storytelling, why does that location or that element of a story work for that genre?
Well, I think it's particularly, I think you said it, the underworld. It's a kind of interzone where, you know, there's often alcohol or other types of illicit drugs and activities going on, and where a certain kind of character goes to unravel or unwind. And there's these often clandestine rendezvous that are almost dreamlike that happen. And I think that's the attraction, I think, in terms of noir. It's a nighttime. It's often unsavory characters or people that are intoxicated or, you know, don't fit into the mainstream society. And in the case of Birdland, there's these, you know, women that are going there. The two central women in the story, Merle and Hazel, is working there, and they're trying to sort of shed the trappings of their father's. You know, they're from a wealthy family. Their father's an oil kind of mogul. So for them to go, they're not even professional jazz singers. They're just playing at it. It's a way of getting attention from the guy who runs the club, Starling.
Mm-hmm.
So they're drawn to the same kind of darkness, like moths to a light.
The two characters are sort of the son of a somewhat shady businessman, and of course, with who the president is and just everything, we often hear a lot about these types of people. Was there anything specific you were trying to comment on in that world?
Well, I think, I mean, under the underlying oil issue is, I think both in Canada and the world, oil is sort of what makes the world go round, for better, for worse, and for worse, I would say, in the age of global warming and climate change. It's a nice thing to align the darkness with, because I think in the noir tradition, corruption is one of the hallmarks, you know, of the genre. And when noir first happened, it was around when there was a lot of post-prohibition and a lot of strict societal laws, and then there was the World War II, and all these things stirred up fear and paranoia. And so oil is, I think, one of the hot pokers of corruption right now. And if you follow the money, it usually leads to oil. And so in Birdland, it's no the same. There's oil is the, it represents something dark and corrupt.
One of the characters, the husband, is an ornithologist. How much of that world did you look into and research to sort of craft this mysterious scientist guy?
That's a good question, because all my films, for some reason, tend to have animals in them. You know, even my first film, Arrowhead, which was a dramatic short, had a mastodon story, and had, you know, Project Grizzly, my documentary, has grizzly bears, the herd has reindeer, and so on. This Birdland has birds and dinosaurs, which is, I think, the primordial aspect of it has always attracted to me. So there was a natural, I'm kind of an amateur archaeologist, naturalist, you know, hack scientist, and the way I approach my documentaries was a sort of pseudoscience. And so I did go to the ROM where we shot, and the head ornithologist's last name is Peck, by the way. It just can't make that up. But they were very open and showed me all the structural aspects of how the ornithology department works in the bowels of the underneath the major part of the museum. And I've just been fascinated with what goes on behind the scenes in museums, and the cataloging, and sometimes it's almost like a ruin, you know, even though it's actively involved in science, and they're constantly taking DNA, and there's these drawers, and everything is hidden. So, but to answer your question, I did a fair amount of research on ornithology, and also on the connection between birds and dinosaurs, and that area.
Why do you think you keep coming back to animals, as you say, because they've been in most of the films that you've done over the years?
Well, I think the humans versus nature metaphor is a big thing in my work, and I guess it's something about they represent to me the fragility of our existence. You know, like, for example, birds are these harbingers of our time. They're like the canary in the coal mine. They're beautiful. They're part of what we know of evolution, and how we became aware of evolution. Darwin was really interested in birds and how, you know, selection of the species and origin of the species and all that sort of stuff. So animals, I think I'm interested in that. We are all animals, and so it connects. I'm interested in that connection to the primordial and those pulls of our sort of sex and death and existence and extinction, and those two poles are, I feel, Birdland is trying to situate the characters in that drama that is unfolding right today, you know?
Let's talk about casting. I loved how each role was cast in this film. How involved were you in that? When you were writing your film, did you have, you know, one or two people in mind for each role, or did all of that come out during the production meetings?
There was casting was a demanding process, and the only actor that I had on board from early time, from when I had been developing the script, was David Alpe, and he was an actor who had become a friend, and he was reading early iterations of drafts of the script, and but the other actors came to me via the help of a casting agent, and that process was involved going to readings and getting feedback. But I was really interested in the actors that wanted to go outside of the boundaries of their normal work, and that I was interested in actors that really responded to the material. So rather than their sort of auditions, I was more interested in them sharing ideas and their intellectual, obviously their looks were important, but their response to the material in a visceral way was even more important to me, and their understanding of the script. And so, yeah, that it was casting, we've got a lot of help in the casting.
I think it was Adam Egoyan I read, speaking of David Alpay.
Yeah.
But I think it was Adam that said he finds you to be at least Canada's most idiosyncratic film director. How does it feel to have that type of reputation among your peers?
Well, I think I come to it honestly. I mean, I don't go out and try to be weird or idiosyncratic per se, but I'm interested in, I always believe that the more you could describe, specifically describe a world, the more it becomes universal. And so I'm not interested in just quirky for quirkiness sake or weirdness sake, but it's just, I think, how I see the world. I think the shape of material, the form of material, comes out of how you see the world. And that's part of a strange journey of who you are, what you see unconsciously, but also just where you've been. And I've had a strange sort of journey in my life to arrive at filmmaking, because I didn't just go to film school and start, you know, following, wanting to be Steven Spielberg. I have a very idiosyncratic background from punk rock, music videos, video art, you know, commercials, documentaries, installations. So I have broad interests, and I try to let that come into my work. So I would take it as a compliment.
And also, how do you think, you know, making all these documentaries has sort of shaped how you see the world?
Well, to me, I'm part of that school of character is story, and Birdland is more about spins on ideas and themes rather than straight sort of plot. You know, it's more in that, like a Coen Brothers style film, where it steps outside of the plot, and it's much more character driven, and also allows for the exploration of abstract ideas and exploring thematics. And so yeah, in that sense, I just lost my train. What was the question?
Oh, we were talking about how documentaries.
Okay, So, documentary. I mean, Martin Scorsese, I think, said documentary is the cornerstone of drama, and I think I like to treat the documentary moment and drama as equal goods. So I made a film like The Herd, which is about a reindeer drive that happened in the 30s, and it was a mixture of drama and documentary and actors. And my film Arrowhead, my very first film, short film, is a drama, but it's very much was sort of loosely based on my own growing up in this Thorncliffe Park. So in terms of documentary, it hones your eye, it hones your being able to develop character, and also a sense of place. And I think in Birdland, noirs are very much about a world, about an atmospheric place. And so I spent a great deal of time trying to create this world of Birdland, which is shooting, it takes place in Toronto, but it's not a Toronto that you would see every day. It's right. The Toronto of Birdland, you know. And I think my documentary background of sort of conjuring and expressing location, like I see location as part of the character. Like landscape is character, and so documentary, I think, helps you get your skills like a painter to render that.
Well, the film is Birdland, and it's out in January. Peter Lynch, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Peter Lynch, the writer and director of the new film Birdland, which opens on Friday. Sean Hall and Matthew Rogers now. You heard them open the show there with their lovely intro and their song Forever Fool, off their new album Apocalyptic. They make up the Vancouver-based blues folk duo Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer. But they're also both accomplished musicians in their own right. Prior to their formation, Sean worked in television, and Matt was a film composer, and still is. And their songs have been featured in TV shows like CSI, NCIS New Orleans, Good Wife, and Blue Bloods. But I think what really makes Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer stand out are their live shows. I had the privilege of going to their show here in Toronto at the Great Hall a couple weeks back, and it was a party. It is unlike anything you'll ever experience. It's raucous, it's dancey, it's just a really, really, really good time. I got to speak with him prior to that show about the new album, songwriting, touring, and of course, this freezing weather. Here's me with Sean and Matt of Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer. Yes. Sean Hall, Matthew Rogers, Harpoonist and the Axe Murderer. Hello. Welcome to Toronto, gentlemen.
How are you doing? Thank you for having us in Toronto, your city, mayor.
How are you adjusting to this weather?
A little bit schizophrenic. So I guess I personally am feeling a little bit schizophrenic.
It was the first time we'd seen sunshine in a long time today, though. Albeit it was like negative 10 or something, but it was nice just to get that little bit of vitamin D pouring onto our faces.
Glass half full.
For people who perform for a living, is that a different kind of adjustment, like in terms of getting prepared from the for a show, because the cold weather can affect us in different ways than perhaps a sunny day can on the West Coast?
Yeah. There's, if you're talking about you're talking to a band that uses a lot of things with tubes in it, and you know, just strings, guitar strings alone, harmonicas go sharp if it's really cold. The reeds shrink, as well as other things.
How do you sort of do you you know, are there certain precautions you might take, or how do you sort of deal with that as it comes?
I let things stay in a room and I don't turn them on, so I let them acclimatize.
Yeah, I mean, at least we're not playing outside. You know, we've played outside in negative 20, negative 10 a few times, and that's just not fun. It's like, it's more about survival than it is about how well you're playing music. It's like, can we get through this actually without physically hurting ourselves?
Matt, you and I were joking a little bit before about it was a little bit chaotic today, you know, kind of between soundcheck and interview. And is what does sort of that kind of environment, you know, running around last minute, how does that maybe affect your mindset going into the show? Is a certain amount of chaos good, or does everything need to be really regimented and organized?
For me, regimented and organized. Chaos, I don't thrive in chaos.
No.
I mean, I might occasionally, if there's just like one show here and there where we've got to just like, what's the saying? Just like pull our bootstraps up. Is that the saying?
Yeah.
If that happens occasionally, sure, but I need a moment of peace before the show. I need to just like sit down and have a scotch and a cigar, metaphorically.
Maybe not metaphorically the scotch. Yeah, the chaos is, I mean, if it becomes comedic, how many chaotic things are happening, then you kind of normalize it, and we actually tend to like, you're not going to, you know, if we realize how ridiculous a lot of scenarios are, because we've had, you remember, we played a festival last summer in Ontario that was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And we eventually rose above it because you just don't want to sink with the ship. Mm-hmm.
So the new album out is Apocalypstic. What can you talk about this album a little bit? Where did it come from you in terms of, you know, going from the last album to this one?
I just fired over to you.
We decided to go for something a little more psychedelic. We wanted to try and break away as much as we could manage from the sort of 3.5 minute long song, and just sort of intersperse the album with sort of longer endings, longer middles, bridging two songs together, you know, just getting a little bit more Sgt. Pepper's Heart Sculpt Band with it, basically.
Mm-hmm.
We used a different drummer for the first time. That was sort of a big change, and we all sort of sat in the room and jammed through the tunes, me playing guitar and bass and Sean singing and playing drums, so sort of hashing the tunes out a whole different way. And we got to record in a big, nice studio with lots of old reverbs and all that.
Yeah,
that
nice
stuff,
like
so.
Reverb chambers, yeah. which are pretty cool.
It strikes me that sort of the style that you guys play in, lends for, you know, a lot of freedom, a lot of improvisation, especially in terms of the live shows. How is there a lot, and how different is a song played live versus something that might appear on the album?
Totally different.
Yeah, really different.
I mean, our albums are come together from, you know, full drum kit, real bass, and, you know, layers to produce something that is sort of, you know, we feel is has enough quality to be on radio or whatever, not necessarily pop radio, but you know, that'll translate to listening ears. And it's really fun for us. We thrive doing that because we're both sort of recording studio nerds, and we love making records that way. Whereas live, we have to sort of translate that down to something that two people, often three people, can accomplish. And that means sort of scaling it down to the bare bones. Sometimes that means restructuring songs, just sort of reimagining grooves and everything. Sort of, you often have to build it from scratch.
Yeah, it's like last night was a prime example for myself. I thought I was really excited. I like changed my setup, and I thought I was going to do two jobs with one foot instead of when I changed my percussion to go tambourine and shaker on one foot using my calf and my shin. And I broke the pedal within the first one or two songs, snapped the pedal in half, and then the other pedal broke on its own. And I went, oh, well, that kind of sucks. I just went because I thought that freed up my other foot to do all these other things, but both the pedals broke. And I went, okay, back to the drawing board. And then got up today, and I'm like, okay, forget the shaker. We're going to go rudimentary tambourine, forget all the bells and whistles. And it's like, I feel like anytime Matt and I do things, the only way, if you're rehearsing, then you can try it, or a lot of times it just happens, trial and error happens on stage.
You guys are known for your very sort of high energy performances. In terms of getting to that level of, you know, with yourself, but also with the audience, how do you know when it's working during any given show in terms of getting to the level of where you want it to be at?
People are singing along.
Yeah, when people are singing along, when they're not texting. if someone is texting directly in front of you, you know, then you're like last night someone was texting directly in front of me, and I'm like, yeah, okay, all right, we gotta creep it up a bit more. But that's usually like a good sign, right? If people aren't busy texting, or when they are singing along, it's fantastic.
What is your opinion, you know, because everyone's on their phone these days, and, you know, there was a time when nobody took photos at shows, and now everyone's, you know, Instagramming or Twittering or taking photos. What's your relationship with that like as performers?
I mean, promotion's great. People are taking photos, great. That's awesome.
As long as they get my good side. I'll flag anything that has my bad side on it.
As long as they get something other than a crotch shot, because of the way that we're situated. I don't know. I mean, I think, as long as people are promoting in whatever way, I think a lot of people, myself included, for many, many years, and a lot of times you end up watching a show through your camera and tweeting it out, or not tweeting, no one uses Twitter except Coca-Cola, but you end up like broadcasting it, and you're like, what am I doing? Am I broadcasting the show so that people can see that I'm at the show, or am I actually watching the show? And I think a lot of people do that. They're like, it's like, check me out. Like, I hate to say that I've done that multiple times.
So I heard the single today, sorry if I get the name, Free Fool?
Forever Fool?
Forever Fool. What can you tell us about that track?
It's sort of a slinky, sort of Rolling Stones-esque groove. Just about not letting someone treat you like a fool and sort of getting revenge. If you watch the video for it,
video's good.
Revenge is had.
The video's shot in like famed penthouse. Vancouver's penthouse.
Oh, that's a great location, isn't it?
There's a book out on the famed penthouse.
I heard, did it just close down, or they were?
I don't think so.
don't know.
They were, I don't know, I saw Sam Max post about something happening, something affecting the penthouse. I don't know if it was like new owners or something like that.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
The old owners were offed.
They're in business no matter what, but that's like, I wouldn't want to take over the legacy of that place.
Yeah. How would you describe your writing process overall? Is it lyrics and then music, vice versa? Is it loose? Is it tight?
Music.
I would say there's no rules ever.
Yeah.
There's whatever has happened in the past is, you know, we've tried to do it a certain way, and it's always just finding a new route of doing it, you know. It might start as music, it might start as lyrics, it might start as the two of us just jamming, and something comes out of that.
It rarely starts, like, at a desk in front of a window with paper and a pen.
Staring out into
the
ocean.
Staring out and going like... Yeah, that doesn't really hit too much. The Hemingway vibe. Except for Hemingway's Nighttime Activities, perhaps.
You're playing in the Great Hall, which is a fantastic venue, not only just aesthetically, but acoustically as well, just the reverbs on it. Are there certain adjustments you have to make when playing in a much more open space like this compared to something maybe like the Rio or the Commodore?
Yeah, there's adjustments for just about every single venue you play. Especially in terms of just, the reverb size and the sort of the sound of the room. Not all bars are created equal in terms of acoustics. And even sometimes, you know, the most controlled rooms are not always the most fun because they can feel a little bit just mundane.
And unforgiving.
Yeah, everyone can hear all your mistakes.
we played a place in Brighton? Bristol.
Bristol.
And it was pie wedge shaped place, and it was like sounded like an anechoic chamber nightclub, and it looked like it held 20 people, but apparently it held like 100. And we played that room, and you could barely hear the sound coming out from your front wedge.
Yeah.
So that was like too much. But apparently it was lovely to watch.
I loved that show.
Did
for
you?
The record.
Yeah, okay.
You guys have been playing together for a little over 10 years now, by my account. What is your strangest memory of being on the road?
Oh, there's too many we're not allowed to tell.
There's way too many. There's like, what's the strangest memory? Fuck. Jesus, man. And I'm like, going to the emergency room in San Francisco... That's probably like one of the strangest places I've ever been. And then, stranger yet, going to see a guy named Dr. Seuss afterwards because I broke my nose and I had to get it fixed. And the guy gave me his card and he did tit jobs and ass jobs and all sorts of stuff. And then he gave me his card and said, Dr. Seuss.
Spelt the same way?
Spelt the same fucking way. And I still kept it at home so that because no one believes me. And that was strange. That was that was a very scary. That was actually stranger than it was scary.
Apparently, there was an actual other Dr. Seuss in the same town that the author lived at the same time, and his papers are housed in the Dr. Seuss collection.
Oh, weird.
Yeah,
wow.
It's very strange.
Huh. Wow.
It was like this little Republican California town, and they were like, they didn't really get along because, you know, Dr. Seuss was like this crazy sort of socialist writer, and, you know, here was this very sort of conservative doctor.
Wow.
So
maybe it's the same guy.
Okay, now this guy just did boob jobs.
What about you, man? Anything that sticks out for you?
It's all Sean's adventures. I have
that's not true.
Related my own.
No, that's not true.
Hmm.
Matt's got adventures.
Hmm. Things come to me.
Would you say that you have a favorite song off of Apocalyptic?
I really like Forever Fool. I don't get sick of playing. We play that song every single show. It's the song we start the show with, and I'm always happy to play it. So that's a standout for me.
Promises. Promises I love. I like it. It's a good throwback tune. Maybe because we haven't played it live yet, too. But yeah, Fool Forever feels like... feels great. It feels like just a warm living room in very strange environments whenever we play it. It feels like something is normalized in your life and where you have a routine where you're always in a new fucking place. So it's nice to feel that.
Yeah. How do you find Canadians and Canadiances respond to sort of the type of music and the world that you guys find yourselves in? Because especially I think on the West Coast where you guys are from, it's a lot of, you know, it's more indie, it's a lot of indie rock, indie pop, a little bit of hip hop. But where do you, in terms of the crowds you find, how do you find the response to your type of music?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't paint the broad stroke of saying all Canadian towns are the same, because they're extremely different. You know, Vancouver's was more different from Saskatoon than Vancouver is from Paris. I don't know, I'm just making stuff up. That's not really true. But having played most of the, you know, larger centers in Canada a bunch of times, I think we go into the shows expecting, we're knowing what to expect from those audiences. So knowing that, you know, like, not to diss Toronto right now, but Toronto crowds are a little colder, they're a little harder to reach. So, you know, when they're tapping their foot, that's like some, like, someone going crazy at
Saskatoon. I was just talking to the promoter about that. She said a lot of bands ask her how the show was. She's the promoter of a venue. They'll have a full house here. And they'll ask her afterwards how the show is, because they didn't have a clue. Yeah. And then she'll say, well, she heard, not from what she saw on their faces, but from what they said as they left the venue. Mm-hmm. And so she said, it's just weird that some people you can't, like some Torontonians, you can't tell.
I guess maybe they get in tune with the weather, right? Cold.
They don't want to look too ridiculous. It's a fashionable big city. Some people in smaller towns don't mind looking ridiculous.
And they have to give them a bit of benefit here, like, a lot of good stuff comes through Toronto, so
yeah,
the bar is pretty high. Like,
the bar is, we are shitting blood for the show.
you mentioned both San Francisco and Bristol. What is your experience when you play being a Canadian band in another country?
It's really fun being thought of as sort of an exotic fruit. You
especially
sort of have a little bit of a leg up in the whole situation, right?
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, here it's a little bit less so, and the States even less so almost. So it's nice to hit places where being Canadian just in and of itself is exotic to people.
Yeah.
All right, well, Matt, Sean, thanks so much, guys.
Yeah,
thank you.
Cheers.
Thanks a lot.
That was Sean Hall and Matthew Roberts of Harpoonist and the Axe Murder. That does it for today. Be sure to follow the show on social media at Endeavors Radio, especially our Facebook page. And you can check out the Patreon page at patreon.com/endeavors. Please consider donating. It would really help the show along. Taking you out with Promises, Promises. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time. Ciao for now.